Now back to What Makes It Great, this recorded back in March at the home of What Makes It Great, Merkin Hall, at the Kauffman Music Center in Midtown Manhattan, with your host Rob Capello. This program, Rob, calling Jazz on the Tracks, the train in classic jazz from Miller to Marsalis. We've already heard music of Glenn Miller, Count Basie, and Duke Ellington.
If Ellington's happy-go-lucky local pushed Glenn Miller and Count Basie's musical languages to new levels of dissonance and abstraction, Thelonious Monk, only 6 years after Happy-Go-Lucky Local, took Ellington's musical language into a completely different universe. I mean, Monk was one of the most unique figures in jazz history, both as a person and as a musician. I mean, though the press loved to exaggerate, there's no doubt that his behavior was eccentric by anybody's standards. He wore these strange hats, odd suits, top coats and sunglasses, even when he was indoors. And even his middle name, Thelonious Sphere Monk, was bizarre. He would often go for days without speaking to anybody. And during performances, while the band would continue playing, he would simply stop playing, stand up, and start dancing. In his music and in his life, it was almost impossible to tell when he was being serious and when he was being humorous. And he had such a strange way of playing the piano that critics and audiences were divided over whether it was simply the result of incompetence or an actual aesthetic choice. His playing was blunt, highly percussive, abrupt, angular, and filled with these dramatic silences and hesitations. And his compositions were filled with these strange melodic twists and these wrong note dissonant chords that shocked both critics and audiences. Yet in spite of the fact that he only wrote about 70 pieces in his lifetime, when compared with Ellington, who wrote more than 1,000, he was actually the second most recorded jazz composer in history after Ellington. Little Rudy Tooty, the next piece we're going to look at, was actually the opening number on his first real studio album, Thelonious Monk Trio, recorded with the bassist Gary Mapp and the drummer Art Blakey in 1952. Toot was actually Monk's nickname for his 2-year-old son, Thelonious Monk Jr., hence the title Little Rudy Tooty, which also means small child in the Wolof African language. But actually, the train sounds that generate the key musical idea of this piece refer to a cartoon train that was one of Monk's son's favorite cartoons. One of the most striking things about Monk's compositions is the way that he was somehow often able to contain his wildly advanced melodic and harmonic language within absolutely conventional forms. So many of his most famous pieces are simple 32-bar AABA pieces that are even formally clearer than Chattanooga Choo Choo. His music somehow manages to be both bizarre and conventional, enigmatic and bluntly straightforward at the same time. The overall form of Little Rudy Tooty couldn't possibly be clearer. After a brief 3-measure introduction, Monk plays an absolutely straightforward AABA 32-bar chorus, couldn't be clearer, followed by a chorus and a half solo, and then a return. That's it, utterly straightforward. But within this utterly straightforward conventional form lies some incredibly original, eccentric music that somehow manages to turn train dissonance into an entire musical language. Now, to give you some perspective on how Monk distorts convention, I've written a completely normal version of the introduction and the main idea of the piece, which I'm going to turn into Monk step by step. So here's my version of the opening. I'll play my notes, and he'll play the Monk notes. So it starts like this, my version. A 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. Monk. Me. That's my version. Now, in my version of the main tune, you should never clap for my versions. In my version of the main tune, I had my version of the piece's train chord resolve sweetly. That's my version. Monk, however, does 2 radical things. First, he changes 2 notes in the train chord itself, and I'll do it step by step so you can see how it becomes more dissonant. Here was my chord. First, I'll change the top note. But then I'll change 1 more note to really make it dissonant. Sort of like Ellington to the 3rd power. But also, his chord never resolves. Mine resolved. His just sits there. No resolution whatsoever. And that's actually the only chord in the entire opening phrase. Everything else is a single line piano melody which is bizarrely doubled by the double bass, two octaves lower. And the train chord. That's it. And then to put that odd train chord even more bluntly in your face, he simply repeats that opening two-measure idea three times and then resolves it the fourth time. And one weird note makes the resolution. And to highlight the weirdness, I have written a normal version of the last two notes. So everything else in this phrase is Monk, but the last two notes, sadly, are mine. So here's Monk with me at the ending. A one, two, three, four. Again. Me. But instead of my normal ending, he changes one note, and that one note makes this wonderfully witty, uniquely deadpan ending. So instead of, here's his version. A one, two, three, four. Now, following our standard AABA form, you're experts on this, he simply repeats that opening phrase identically, and the B section of the tune is a classic example of Monk's unique, to use a kind of a Chinese restaurant metaphor, sweet and sour harmony. Here's the all-sweet capo version he might have written. That's the nice version. Here's Monk's angular wrong note version. But after that surprisingly dissonant measure, he gives us a conventional little three-note connector from old-school stride piano, like a found object from the past, sweet after sour. Here's the continuation again in my all-sweet version. Here's Monk's dissonant angular version. Pushed even further. But just at the breaking point, we have no idea what key that note's in or how it's going to resolve. He gives us a sweet, clear resolution. Couldn't be neater. And the passage that returns us to the opening is again classic Monk, setting up an expectation and instantly defeating it. So he begins with a measure that bizarrely contrasts swing rhythm and straight rhythm. You hear a swing, then straight. A bizarre measure like this. Weird as it is, a normal continuation would at least repeat it lower like this. But not Monk. Instead, he does this. And somehow we're back at the opening. A one, two, three, four. A chorus and a half solo follows, which is going to be improvised by Kyle tonight. But if you listen on YouTube, you can hear Monk's truly eccentric solo. And you'll hear in the middle, he discovered that at the studio he was recording, one of the notes in the piano was out of tune. And so he kept hammering away at it 30 times just to make sure that the engineer felt badly that that note was out of tune. I'm told that Kyle is going to somehow incorporate over and over again into this improvisation, but most of it will be actually Kyle's. Then, after the solo, the B section returns, followed by that opening phrase, which Monk extends in his uniquely bizarre, eccentric way. We once again come back to that original, witty ending with the one strange note that ended the first part of the piece like this. A one, two, three, four. He then repeats the idea three times, changing the ending with a different, weird, sour last note each time. Each one is worse than the one before. A one, two, three, four. Try this one. Now, as if we're gonna open and end. And we think for surely we're done. That's the opening one. But just when you think it's over, he adds one more version with an incredibly dissonant final note that refuses to resolve in any way and is just left hanging. The piece ends without any resolution whatsoever, an enigma like Monk himself. Here's the very ending. A one, two, three, four. That's it. And now from 1952, little Rudy Tooty, Thelonious Monk. Kyle LaFave.
Again, on the bass, Dan Shimolinski. And on drums, Joe Perry.
No one in jazz has been a more ardent ambassador for the music of Duke Ellington than Wynton Marsalis, and it's impossible to imagine a perfect homage to Ellington's Happy-Go-Lucky Local and all of his other famous train pieces than Marsalis' 1998 12-part jazz suite, Big Train. Caboose is, appropriately enough, the final movement of the 50-minute suite, and it works with material heard earlier and throughout the entire piece. According to Marsalis, quote, Big Train starts with an adult asking, quote, where does the big train go? The caboose is from a child's perspective. The child wonders not where, but how does the big train go? The story comes from my childhood. We grew up next to some railroad tracks. My mama would ask, how does the train go? Branford would answer, woo, woo. And I would say, no, it goes kanunk, kanunk. And woo, woo, and kanunk, kanunk are actually the two main ideas in the entire piece. I wrote this piece for my son, Jasper, just like Monk, who wrote his piece for his son. When he was little, he loved trains. Now, the movement starts with the conductor shouting, all aboard. And just like Ellington, Marsalis takes a simple chord, but he adds one dissonant note. Here's the core of the opening.
All aboard!
Two, three.
All aboard!
Two, three. That's kanunk, kanunk. Now, to update Ellington's train onomatopoeia, Marsalis adds three stratospherically high screech trumpets for the train whistle. This is not supposed to be beautiful. This is a train whistle. One, two, three. Don't try that at home. Good. Now, here's the highly imaginative combination of all that. Two, three. Two, three. That's the beginning. More than 50 years after Glenn Miller's Chattanooga Choo Choo began with his version of Train Onomatopoeia, Marsalis actually does the same effect, but in an updated big band language with updated harmony. An astonishingly dissonant fortissimo blast from the full ensemble that Marsalis marks, quote, like a train horn with air stopping, plus station bells and the percussion kicks off the train ride, followed by that kanunk, kanunk of the moving train, which is stomped by the players in the orchestra. And that's one of the key ideas both of Caboose and the entire suite, like this. A one, two, three. Kanunk, kanunk. What follows again is an Ellington idea, but brilliantly updated by a half a century of harmonic, instrumental, and rhythmic developments as incredibly dissonant train whistle blasts, honks, and wah-wah wails ricochet back and forth in increasingly complicated rhythms between the ensemble's three wind groups, between the saxes, the trumpets, and the trombones, like this. One, two, blast! Honk! Whack! Again, no one is dancing to this music either. Like Happy-Go-Lucky Local, the opening features another one of those chugging ostinatos or repeated patterns in the piano and the bass using the movement's core kanunk, kanunk rhythm. But it's actually much simpler than Ellington's, and it grounds the entire piece like this. One, two, three. Kanunk, 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 kanunk. And just like Ellington, Marsalis works with layers above the ostinato. The trombones play the same chords with open harmony that comes, I will promise you, as a real relief after the dissonant blasts of that opening like this. A one, two, three. Open chords. A little blues color. Above this, a broad, relaxed singing melody that seems to have all the time in the world and harks back to some distant historical past is played by the saxes in unison and is briefly interrupted by a short, fortissimo train whistle blast in the brass. A one, two, three. Train whistle blast. As the long breath melody continues, the harmony finally moves off our ostinato, but it's still kanunk, kanunk, rhythm continues. And there's a fantastic moment where those unison saxes briefly break into harmony. I just want you to raise your hand when you hear the unison saxes briefly break into harmony. And whatever you do, whether you get it right or wrong, I'll tell the radio audience you got it right. Here we go. A one, two. They're in unison. Raise your hand when they move to harmony. Fantastic moment. Again, in a superb update of Ellington, that ostinato returns, but with a highly dissonant train whistle blast above it, first fortissimo, but then in a highly imaginative orchestration, it's repeated pianissimo like an echo. First fortissimo. A one, two, three. This leads right into a lovely little lullaby for the saxes. Again, still over our ostinato. The number of different moods that Marsalis is able to generate out of this simple pattern is truly amazing. Over the ostinato. A one, two, three. Brass, unison, then harmony. Fast figure, accented trills. Marsalis said, quote, "I gave Joe Temperley the baritone melody that signals the end of the song. I do this in a lot of my pieces. Joe is like a grandfatherly voice for our band, and his statement of the melody says to us, quote, okay, Joe has spoken about this. The warmth and integrity of his sound gives the piece a sense of finality." So still above our ostinato, the single line of the Barry sax gradually builds as first the rest of the saxes get added, then the brass, and we get our only real counterpoint in the piece, but always everything above, kanunk, 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 kanunk. A one, two, three. Brass. Counterpoint. Back to Barry sax. A fragment of what sounds like an old work song that seems to come from some earlier century briefly floats in over our ostinato, repeats, and resolves like this. A one, two, three. Repeat. And it repeats quieter. The dissonant train whistle blast returned, but now with added sax honks, but like everything in this piece, it all ultimately resolves to kanunk, kanunk. One, two, blast! Kanunk, kanunk. Finally, in one last brilliantly theatrical moment, the entire band sings an invented song that feels like the motto of the piece and that somehow links this piece to centuries of African-American experience with the railroads. But as always, over our never-ending, now timeless ostinato. Kanunk, kanunk. One, two.
Go
And after the tune's repeated over and over, resolving the entire 50-minute suite, the piece ends with one final terrific moment of train onomatopoeia, as the band blows air through their horns, recreating the sound of the air brakes that stop the train and end the piece in this fantastic ending. Here's how it ends. Oh, one, two. Corn Weibel's book, Railroads in the African American Experience, ends with these thought-provoking words. Quote, for more than 150 years, the railroads were linked to blacks' quest for a better life, a better job, a better status. At times, railroads represented hope. Occasionally, they bestowed opportunity. Frequently, they offered only escape. Until recently, they brought exploitation and racism. For many blacks, positive changes and new chances came too late. And now, the African-American railroad era is history. But though that railroad era may be history, the music that grew out of it, as I hope you've heard tonight, is truly alive and well. And at this extraordinary moment in our country's history, a moment where polarization and division has reached unprecedented levels, a moment overwhelmingly filled with no, this music is the music of yes. The music of joy, the music of hope, and it is an essential reminder that even in the most difficult of circumstances, it's still possible to say yes to life, as this music does in every measure, to say yes to it all. We now conclude the pre-Q&A pre-potential fantastic encore you won't want to miss at the end of the Q&A portion of the program with Caboose from Big Train by Wynton Marsalis.
Train go.
I mean, is that not a fantastic band? Kyle LaFade. All right, just a few questions, and then maybe you'll have that final number. We'll see. Who has a question for anyone in the band? Yes, go ahead, sure.
What kinds of music do you play? How wide a variety?
What kinds of music do you play, and how wide a variety?
So, to give an idea of the type of music we play, knowing that we are called the Kyle LaFade Dance Party already tells you a little bit, because we draw a lot of inspiration from swing music and Latin music, especially Afro-Cuban music, a lot of funk and soul and R&B music. I also write all of the charts that we play, and so we do a lot of my own original music, which takes those influences, as well as popular culture, TV shows, movies, video games, a big range.
Anyone else? Yes, go ahead.
There's a noticeable absence of women in the band.
Women in the band.
So, yeah, about who we have in the band. My hiring process for the musicians I use is 100% based on the skills of the musicians. I don't take into account their gender, their race, their age, their social status, anything like that. So whenever I need a recommendation for a musician, all I see is a name and a phone number. And then I hear the person play and they sound amazing. And these are the most amazing musicians who are available to me. So I called them all and I'm very happy that they're here to play.
Anyone else? One more? Anyone up there? Yes, go ahead, sure.
When you guys are in that last song doing the stuff that's not playing your instruments, does that feel weird? Or is that kind of...
Great question. He wanted to know, when they're doing the stuff that isn't playing their instruments, like singing or tapping their feet, do you feel weird or are you happy to be doing it? Who wants to answer that one? Go ahead. Have you got a mic there?
So, I mean, that's kind of just part of being a musician in general, is creating a show for the audience. So you don't go to listen to a show. You never say that, right? You go to see a show. So there's a lot of aspects of playing music that are non-music related, as in music and dance go together, you know, moving everything, and a lot of sounds that aren't necessarily created by your instrument. So it doesn't feel weird. No, I wouldn't say that. It's pretty much every day for us, so...
Yeah, and as I mentioned, you know, the whole history is of jazz and music in general is accepting things that were once considered noise or ugly as part of music, and it starts with Beethoven, because people said the same thing about Beethoven's music. How could you have those ugly sax wails in the Fifth Symphony? But the idea of that things that were not considered beautiful or that were considered noise gradually become part of the vocabulary, and so musicians are constantly looking to expand the vocabulary of what's included in a piece of music, and Marsalis expands it by including the stomping and the caulking. So I think it's just part of that expanded vocabulary. Maybe one more, and then we'll have one final. Yes, go ahead.
I was wondering if any of these young men were classically trained in Manhattan School of Music or Madison.
Yes, yeah, so she wanted to know if any of them were trained classically at Manhattan or many of the schools, and the answer is definitely yes, but go ahead.
A variety of the players have classical backgrounds. Some of them studied instruments other than the instrument you're seeing them play. As you saw, a lot of the sax players were playing clarinets as well. And most of these musicians I met either during my time as a student or through recommendations from other students at Juilliard and the Manhattan School of Music, I think, pretty much. Did anybody not go to one of those two places? Oh, Alex! Alex Hahn, our lead alto player, he flew all the way from LA to play here. And he studied at North Texas and USC on saxophone. So yeah, thank you, Alex.
Well, I heard somebody playing Pulcinella downstairs. So somebody took classical. That was you? It was Pulcinella. That's good. Would you like to hear one final? Good. So before you go out to sign up for next year, here's one final. It's the quintessential train piece, the one we could not leave off the program, and I think you'll possibly recognize it. It's another Duke Ellington but Billy Strayhorn tune.
This one's going to feature Joseph Boga on the trumpet.
And being too modest, it's also going to feature Kyle LaFade on the piano right now. Thank you.
With that stirring version performed by Kyla Thade, Dance Party Big Band of Duke Ellington, Billy Strayhorn's classic Take the A Train. This very different episode of What Makes It Great with your host, conductor and commentator Rob Capello, comes to a close. This episode called Jazz on the Tracks, The Train in Classic Jazz from Miller to Marsalis. As with all these episodes that we bring you of What Makes It Great that are recorded at the home of What Makes It Great, Merkin Hall at the Kaufman Music Center in Midtown Manhattan, this recorded back in March, there are a few people we wish to thank for making it possible. Of course, Rob Capello, also Lydia Kontos, Executive Director of Kaufman Music Center, Emily Krell, Merkin Concert Hall Producer and Managing Director, Benjamin Young, Technical Manager, and Joan Jastrzebski, Communications Director. Our recording engineer for this program was Bill Moss. You can find out all you wish to know about Merkin Hall and the Kaufman Music Center by going to their website, Kaufman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N, kaufmanmusiccenter.org. What Makes It Great is made possible in part through the sponsorship of David and Phyllis, because classical music is essential, and also Dragon Thistle Studio in Solbury, Bucks County, Pennsylvania. This concludes our fourth season of What Makes It Great programs, which have originated from Merkin Hall at Kaufman Music Center, but also in Princeton with our November program of Great Choruses from Handel's Messiah. Our next What Makes It Great will be a rebroadcast coming your way in July, and we look forward to a fifth season of these programs as hosted by Rob Capello. I'm David Ozenberg. What Makes It Great is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.